Chapter 158. Going to a distant country expressly in order that he may be fully understood and appreciated for the first time. I wish Mr. Micawber to take his stand upon that vessel's prow and firmly say, "This country I am come to conquer. Have you honors? Have you riches? Have you posts of profitable pecuniary emolument? Let them be brought forward. They are mine." Apostrophe, Mr. Micawber, glancing at us all, seemed to think there was a good deal in this idea. "I wish Mr. Micawber, if I make myself understood," apostrophe said Mrs. Micawber, in her argumentative tone, "to be the Caesar of his own fortunes. That, my dear Mr. Copperfield, appears to me to be his true position. From the first moment of this voyage, I wish Mr. Micawber to stand upon that vessel's prow and say, enough of delay, enough of disappointment, enough of limited means. That was in the old country. This is the new. Produce your reparation. Bring it forward." Apostrophe, Mr. Micawber folded his arms in a resolute manner, as if he were then stationed on the figurehead. "And doing that," apostrophe said Mrs. Micawber, apostrophe feeling his position, "am I not right in saying that Mr. Micawber will strengthen, and not weaken, his connection with Britain? An important public character arising in that hemisphere, shall I be told that its influence will not be felt at home? Can I be so weak as to imagine that Mr. Micawber, wielding the rod of talent and of power in Australia, will be nothing in England? I am but a woman, but I should be unworthy of myself and of my papa if I were guilty of such absurd weakness." Apostrophe, Mrs. Micawber's conviction that her arguments were unanswerable gave a moral elevation to her tone which I think I had never heard in it before. "And therefore it is," apostrophe said Mrs. Micawber, "that I the more wish that, at a future period, we may live again on the parent soil. Mr. Micawber, maybe I cannot disguise from myself that the probability is Mr. Micawber will be a page of history, and he ought then to be represented in the country which gave him birth and did not give him employment." Apostrophe, apostrophe, my love, apostrophe observed Mr. Micawber, "it is impossible for me not to be touched by your affection. I am always willing to defer to your good sense. What will be. Heaven forbid that I should grudge my native country any portion of the wealth that may be accumulated by our descendants." Apostrophe, apostrophe, that's well, apostrophe said my aunt, nodding towards Mr. Peggotty, "and I drink my love to you all, and every blessing and success attend you." Apostrophe, apostrophe, Mr. Peggotty put down the two children he had been nursing, one on each knee, to join Mr. and Mrs. Micawber in drinking to all of us in return, and when he and the Micawbers cordially shook hands as comrades, and his brown face brightened with a smile, I felt that he would make his way, establish a good name, and be beloved, go where he would. Even the children were instructed, each to dip a wooden spoon into Mr. Micawber's pot, and pledge us in its contents. When this was done, my aunt and Agnes rose, and parted from the emigrants. It was a sorrowful farewell. They were all crying, the children hung about Agnes to the last, and we left poor Mrs. Micawber in a very distressed condition, sobbing and weeping by a dim candle that must have made the room look, from the river, like a miserable lighthouse. I went down again next morning to see that they were away. They had departed, in a boat, as early as 5 o'clock. It was a wonderful instance to me of the gap such partings make, that although my association of them with the tumble-down public house and the wooden stairs dated only from last night, both seemed dreary and deserted, now that they were gone. In the afternoon of the next day, my old nurse and I went down to Gravesend. We found the ship in the river, surrounded by a crowd of boats, a favorable wind blowing, the signal for sailing at her masthead. I hired a boat directly, and we put off to her, and getting through the little vortex of confusion, of which she was the center, went on board. Mr. Peggotty was waiting for us on deck. He He told me that Mr. Micawber had just now been arrested again and for the last time at the suit of Heap, and that, in compliance with a request I had made to him, he had paid the money, which I repaid him. He then took us down between decks, and there, any lingering fears I had of his having heard any rumors of what had happened, were dispelled by Mr. Micawber's coming out of the gloom, taking his arm with an air of friendship and protection, and telling me that they had scarcely been asunder for a moment since the night before last. It was such a strange scene to me, and so confined and dark, that, at first, I could make out hardly anything. But, by degrees, it cleared, as my eyes became more accustomed to the gloom, and I seemed to stand in a picture by Ostade. Among the great beams, bolts, and ring bolts of the ship, and the emigrant berths, and chests, and bundles, and barrels, and heaps of miscellaneous baggage lighted up, here and there, by dangling lanterns, and elsewhere by the yellow daylight straying down a windsail or a hatchway, were crowded groups of people, making new friendships, taking leave of one another, talking, laughing, crying, eating, and drinking. Some, already settled down into the possession of their few feet of space, with their little households arranged, and tiny children established on stools, or in dwarf elbow chairs. Others, despairing of a resting place, and wandering disconsolately. From babies who had but a week or two of life behind them, to crooked old men and women who seemed to have but a week or two of life before them, and from ploughmen bodily carrying out soil of England on their boots, to smiths taking away samples of its soot and smoke upon their skins, every age and occupation appeared to be crammed into the narrow compass of the tween decks. As my eye glanced round this place, I thought I saw sitting, by an open port, with one of the Micawber children near her, a figure like Emily's. It first attracted my attention, by another figure parting from it with a kiss, and as it glided calmly away through the disorder, reminding me of Agnes. But in the rapid motion and confusion, and in the unsettlement of my own thoughts, I lost it again, and only knew that the time was come when all visitors were being warned to leave the ship, that my nurse was crying on a chest beside me, and that Mrs. Gummidge, assisted by some younger stooping woman in black, was busily arranging Mr. Peggotty's goods. "Is there any last word, Master Davy?" " said he. "Is there any one forgotten thing afore we parts? " "One thing." said one. "Martha." " He touched the younger woman I have mentioned on the shoulder, and Martha stood before me. "Heaven bless you, you good man." " cried one. "You take her with you." " she answered for him, with a burst of tears. I could speak no more at that time, but I wrung his hand. And if ever I have loved and honored any man, I loved and honored that man in my soul. The ship was clearing fast of strangers. The greatest trial that I had remained. I told him what the noble spirit that was gone had given me in charge to say at parting. It moved him deeply. But when he charged me, in return, with many messages of affection and regret for those deaf ears, he moved me more. The time was come. I embraced him, took my weeping nurse upon my arm, and hurried away. On deck, I took leave of poor Mrs. Micawber. She was looking distractedly about for her family, even then, and her last words to me were that she never would desert Mr. Micawber. We went over the side into our boat, and lay at a little distance, to see the ship wafted on her course. It was then calm, radiant sunset. She lay between us, and the red light, and every taper line and spar was visible against the glow. A sight at once so beautiful, so mournful, and so hopeful, as the glorious ship, lying, still, on the flushed water, with all the life on board her crowded at the bulwarks, and there clustering, for a moment, bareheaded and silent, I never saw. Silent, only for a moment. As the sails rose to the wind, and the ship began to move, There broke from all the boats three resounding cheers, which those on board took up, and echoed back, and which were echoed and re-echoed. My heart burst out when I heard the sound, and beheld the waving of the hats and handkerchiefs, and then I saw her. Then I saw her, at her uncle's side, and trembling on his shoulder. He pointed to us with an eager hand, and she saw us, and waved her last goodbye to me. I, Emily, beautiful, and drooping, cling to him with the utmost trust of thy bruised heart, for he has clung to thee, with all the might of his great love. Surrounded by the rosy light, and standing high upon the deck, apart together, she clinging to him, and he holding her, they solemnly passed away. The night had fallen on the Kentish hills, when we were rowed ashore and fallen darkly upon me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.